This is Andrew Light. I'm a senior fellow here at the Center for American Progress. And I'm here today with Andrew Feinberg, who is a professor of the philosophy of technology at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver, Canada. Andrew's in town this week to attend the Society for the Social Studies of Science meeting. And he's going to talk to us today about the work that he's done over the course of his career in philosophy of technology. And then we'll turn it forward to focus on new developments in communications technology, online community, new media that are impacting and changing our lives today. So, Andrew, thanks very much for coming.
I'm pleased to be here.
So you first started working in areas on technology when? How early in your work in did you start working on questions of technology and the relationship between philosophy and technology?
When I was a graduate student at the University of California, San Diego, with Herbert Marcuse, a German Marxist philosopher who was quite original and innovative, and he developed a very harsh critique of modern technology in his book One Dimensional Man, and that interested me a great deal. I wrote some things about popular culture and technology at that time. But then for many years, I did other things. At the end of the 80s, a doctor friend of mine invited me to help him start a medical institute that was dedicated to experimental research on human beings in order to find cures for neurologic diseases. And I got involved then in a number of discussions of ethics, applied ethics, problems with science and technology and humanity and how they relate. And a few years later, the involvement became even deeper. I worked with the Western Behavioral Sciences Institute in La Jolla, where we essentially invented online education. We were the people who created the first program. And that got me in touch with all sorts of people, high-level people in industry. One day, the vice president of the Digital Equipment Corporation, which is a big computer company, invited me to lunch, and he asked me at lunch, Andrew, he said, what do you think the future of the personal computer will be? This is like 1983. And I had this sudden revelation. Here I was, a student of Herbert Marcuse, this obscure German Marxist radical philosopher, being asked about the future of technology by somebody who was going to make that future. And I realized that this was, after all, I was involved in something very important, that I had to reconsider all my views and try and understand from out of my experience what I thought about technology. And that's when I really began to try and develop my own philosophy of technology.
So tell me about the work that you were originally doing on online education. I mean, what were sort of the shapes of the platforms that were being designed at that time?
Well, of course, it was quite different. The computer, personal computer, was very expensive, and by comparison with a contemporary mobile phone or Palm Pilot or any of these devices, feeble. We started with Apple IIe's that were donated by Apple, and those computers, I think, had 48K of RAM. And today a computer has gigabytes of RAM, thousands of times as much. And we had modems given to us by one of the people who really started the commercial modem business, Dennis Hayes. And those modems operated at 300 baud. Today, you know, 56,000 is a telephone connection, and Ethernet connections are much faster. So we found a proprietary system that would allow people to meet in groups, sort of the equivalent of what today would be called a web forum. And we found the system. It was operated out of the New Jersey Institute of Technology, and we decided we would have professors talk to students on this system, essentially exchange messages, sort of like an email, but in a group. And it's asynchronous, so you didn't have to all be on at the same time, because we planned to have high-level executives from all over the world participating. These were the only people who could afford our program. Many academics were excited about participating. in those days, it was a frontier. We would give them a computer, which was beyond their means, and some money. And so we had very prominent people willing to work with us as teachers. And the executives who came were very highly self-selected. That is to say, most people we approached about this idea couldn't understand it. They couldn't make any sense out of it. They weren't interested. But there were some more intellectually oriented executives in high positions who got their companies to sponsor them. And we started with a very small group, but it gradually grew over a period of 10 years or so to over 100 participants. And we made the basic discoveries that anyone on a frontier is likely to make about how things work. And they're still valid. Those ideas are still valid, and they're much more, of course, widely known now than at the time. Our program was not supported by major academic institutions, so it remained quite marginal. Today, the Army has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on similar programs. Every university, every important university, has online education facilities that it uses in one way or another. The University of Phoenix is a big operator in this field. So we didn't get rich, but we had some good ideas, and they have spread by osmosis into the whole of American society now.
Right. And then you were funded later, I think in the early 90s, to begin doing work on online communities, grants from the National Science Foundation to try to think about this. What were some of the major conclusions that you came to through that stage of your work?
Well, that's a little bit later, when many more people were using computer networks. And at first they used proprietary networks. Prodigy was a famous one. And then, of course, eventually everything turned out, came up on the web. So you could see a trend developing. People were forming groups around their common interests in the 90s. For example, hobbyist groups, especially computer hobbyists, but also in other areas. Illnesses would isolate people, but then they could try and connect with other people who had similar problems on computer networks. So this, the flowering of this phenomenon of online community was not organized, sponsored, or developed by any large corporation, by the government. It was a complete bottom-up, grassroots phenomenon. And it was possible on these networks because the networks didn't really know what they were for. They didn't have a fully dedicated purpose yet. They were waiting to see what people would make of them. And that gave opportunities for innovation to ordinary people, because I think you have to consider online community a kind of bottom-up innovation that emerged from the mass of users of these networks. And so we were doing research on this for the National Science Foundation, which has a branch that studies social and human and ethical problems associated with technology and science.
So I remember your first book in this field was Critical Theory of Technology.
Yes.
And there you begin developing an account of, I think, really sort of firstly the contrast between how you describe the contrast between bottom-up versus top-down approaches to trying to develop technology or to innovation that you've developed over a number of books since then. Could you sort of say something about one of the key ideas there is something you call democratic rationalization as a way of describing sort of partly a different pathway to getting towards innovation, and then a sort of a preferred pathway, really, to where you think innovation should go. Am I correct?
Yes, that's a good summary. Rationalization is, of course, the process in which we improve our ability to manage and control resources and human beings for ends, usually economic ends of some sort. Rationalization is a key process in all modern societies. We take a given way of doing things and we try and improve it, and we call that making it more rational. We increase efficiency and control. But rationalization is imposed from the top by hierarchical organizations in modern societies. That's how we know how to get things done for the most part. So
the classic assembly line.
Yeah, that's
like a Ford's assembly line textbook rationalization.
Exactly.
We'll get down to measuring the amount of time it takes for each operation, putting a car together so that we can get from point A to point B, and the B is the finished automobile and then all the steps in between.
Exactly. And this is a continuing process. And, of course, it was called scientific management by Frederick Taylor around the turn of the 20th century, but it's not really science. It's a kind of there is measurement and there are some theories and ideas, but it's not about experimental knowledge of nature. It's pretty vague stuff compared to actual science. So there's room for lots of variations and mistakes. And in fact, when you make elaborate plans to rationalize something, it usually doesn't work exactly the way you intended. So management theorists have known for a long time that initiatives from the bottom could be important in implementing rationalization schemes. And even the word rationalization is sometimes used to describe small changes made from the shop floor, for example, to improve productivity. So this is, of course, a kind of bottom-up rationalization. Well, what's happening in modern societies today, when you see these, for example, in relation to the Internet, are not just small changes. You're seeing a rather unrationalized, disorganized system, chaotic system, the Internet, which doesn't really have a hierarchical command center of some sort, being modified quite drastically by bottom-up initiatives. And those initiatives produce good results. It's not as though somehow the ordinary people are unable to coordinate their actions and to do useful things. They're quite good at it. I want to call this kind of large-scale bottom-up innovation democratic rationalization. It's a kind of rationalization in that it does improve the system and give it a way of getting things done. But it's not imposed by a hierarchy. So my assumption is that democratic rationalization will have some properties different from the kinds of things that are done by the authorities in hierarchical organizations. The values may be different, the orientation different. And in the long run, of course, one would prefer to have more democracy rather than less. The key argument here has to do with whether you can still have an efficient modern society with a lot of democratic intervention from below. And some people will say, no, that's impossible. You need very tightly controlled systems. I'm on the other side of that argument. I think that, on the contrary, without a lot of input from below, you don't get anywhere. You don't have innovation and creativity. And very inhuman things are likely to happen, not necessarily because the people at the top are evil, but because they won't see everything that's important about the situations they're creating for their subordinates.
Right. So let's go through a couple of examples in your work where you've really, I think, I've watched you over the years really think through this problem and these contrasts and then come to a theoretical account of what really is the process that's going on. So one of the core examples you find not only in critical theory of technology but in later works like alternative modernity is your study of the Minitel in France. Now,
yes.
This is probably a technology that a lot of people don't recall. So tell us, what is a Minitel and what was the lesson that you learned about this early experiment in kind of top-down state-sponsored telecommunication gone awry?
In the early 1980s, I did some work for the French telephone company, and this got me in touch with a really important and interesting innovation. At that time, computer networks were created in Europe by several different national telecoms, and these networks were supposed to help modernize communications and distribute information to the public from official sources, newspapers, and so on. There was a lot of interest in this and a lot of investment. The only network that worked was the French one, This was called the Minitel network, or Teletel. And it worked because they gave away 6 million free terminals to anyone who had a phone. So you could just plug in this little terminal. You'd get it at the phone store and bring it home, and it was, oh, I don't know, smaller than those old Macs that we used to have on our desks. So you could just carry it around. It plugged into the telephone, and you could get information from it. Well, soon after they started delivering these things, some hackers broke into one of the sites and used it in order to send messages to everyone who's connected to that site. And then gradually, I mean, first the owners of the site were furious. Their system was hacked. But then they saw, aha, here's a way to make money. Because you have to know that the Minitel system was a paying system. You paid on your phone bill for using it by the minute. And then the money was distributed to the service that had attracted your usage. Well, so these people started then to create programs to enable users to chat online. This is really one of the original instant messaging systems. So
originally it was just sort of like passive information. You could go to a site and buy your train tickets. You could look up, grocery stores, like a sort of an online telephone book, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then it was turned from that sort of passive information to an active system where actually you could get one-to-one communication.
Yeah, it became – or one-to-many. It became a system of human communication. And there's a great irony here because the system was invented and huge sums poured into developing it. You can imagine 6 million terminals must have cost them a bundle. It was developed in order to modernize French society along the lines of a highly rational, efficient, technically sophisticated society. And it turned out that what mostly people wanted to do with instant messaging was get dates. So it went from cold to hot all of a sudden in a space of a few months. And the meaning of the computer was transformed because instead of being an information system, it became a communication system. And for me, this was a model of democratic rationalization. Because, I mean, even though you could make fun of the French for seeking dates, although, after all, why not? The idea of human communication on computer networks is extremely important for us today. If you didn't have this possibility, if the Internet hadn't made it easy for us to do this, we would be just as isolated and provincial and cut off from the world as people were before the Internet was introduced.
Right.
But the people who run the world would surely have figured out how to communicate. They'd be way ahead of us.
Right.
As it is, we have some trouble defending our right to use the Internet for communication against commercial pressures on the Internet.
Sure.
So I think this was actually a tremendous positive step for democracy and freedom, even though much of the usage we would now consider to be purely personal and private.
And it seems to me also that, the sorts of things that you focus on, the claim is not just simply about hardware, obviously. It's about human relationships and the use of these technologies, but also networks of humans working together. So I'm thinking here of the examples in your work of the impact of AIDS activist organizations on the clinical trial process in the United States. Could you say something about that example and how that's an example also of democratic rationalization?
That's a very interesting case. I worked with this medical institute in the late 80s on the problem of ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. It's a rare disease. The people who suffered from this disease die very quickly from it, but they remain lucid to the end. Most of these people wanted some access to experimental treatments since there were no treatments at all. But a kind of paternalism in the medical community said, well, we have to protect them from themselves. They can't really freely decide. So there was very little access to experimentation. When AIDS struck the gay community a few years later, the same mentality tended to reduce the opportunities to participate in experiments. And experimental designs were also not very – not kind to the patients. But those patients, unlike the Lou Gehrig's disease patients that I had dealt with, those AIDS patients were organized by political groups, civil rights organizations of gay people, and they were able to fight back. And they demanded that the medical community, in a sense, let them in as so they could become insiders in the process of designing and experiments and distributing opportunities to participate. And this was at first resisted by the medical community. They said, well, you know, you'll just kill off the science that's going to cure you. But in fact, they were able to make accommodations, changes in procedures, and expand greatly the opportunities to participate. And all of this resulted in a significant and beneficial, humanly beneficial changes in medical in the practice of medical experimentation. It didn't destroy medicine or science. The adjustments were possible, and I think that's generally the case. It's not always the case, but it's very often the case that systems that are defended as absolutely essential, either for reasons of economic efficiency or scientific necessity, often are much more flexible than their advocates claim and can be modified to take into account a wider range of human needs than at first seemed possible.
Any current examples that you're thinking about where it looks like we see a policy opportunity to make the decisions about which way we're going to go in terms of a structure which will try to control things or create the opportunity for users or intentional communities to create new innovation?
Well, look at the mobile phone question. Right now, the FCC is considering rules to protect net neutrality in the mobile phone business. This, I think, is a very important moment in the history of communications. If the mobile phone business continues to develop as it has the last few years, the Internet, a large portion of the Internet, which will go on increasingly on mobile phones, will be proprietary. And the space for innovation and creation, which characterized the Internet in its earlier phases, will disappear. It's essential that the mobile phone business not dominate the software that runs on the Internet, but that it be possible for people to create new forms of connection, new forms of sociability. And that's what net neutrality is about. The FCC is considering changes that would enforce it in the mobile phone business. I don't know how exactly where they are at with that right now, but I would be very strongly in favor of that changing the rules in that direction in order that the creativity we've seen on the Internet can continue.
And really, I think the take-home message perhaps for you is like there's much more at stake in this one decision than might at first be apparent. That's not just about this particular technology. It's about really sort of how what is the ethos of our relationship with technology going to be? Is it going to be one of creativity and innovation or one of control?
Exactly. I think that each little question is part of a much bigger one, and that is the question of what kind of a society we're going to live in, because the way technology is designed and configured is the framework of our lives now. It's not simply a question of tools that we use. We live inside this technical system, so it's our environment. It's what we have to work with every day, and if it is not democratized, at least to some degree, in the ways in which we've discussed here, then I think it will become a very oppressive environment, and what Max Weber called an iron cage of rationalization.
Andrew Feinberg, thank you very much for stopping by CAP for this conversation.
Thank you for inviting me.